Texas Monthly Archives, followed by Make Believe Ballroom at 8.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 77 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. As Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas. Coming up this hour, our feature story, Lady Bird Johnson. And then, short features on Frito Pie, The Flash Flood, and The Dust Storm. Hello, this is Michael, reading from the Texas Monthly Archives. I'll be reading a feature from the December 1994 edition of Texas Monthly. Lady Bird looks back. In her own words, a Texas icon reflects on the lessons of a lifetime. By Jan Jarboe Russell. If Texas had a queen, Lady Bird Johnson would be it. But this is a state that loves wealth, yet despises aristocrats, so she will have to settle for the lifetime title of First Lady. It suits her. She looks plain, even common. She has rooted herself firmly in nature through her love of wildflowers, and she stands for the simple pleasures of daily existence. "Do you take your coffee black or with sugar?" she asked, replacing her R with a long southern H. She was standing in the kitchen of her home, which is on a high hillside in northwest Austin. As she poured the coffee with one hand, she leaned on her steaming with the other. Everything about her, from her pleated navy skirt, sensible cotton print shirt, and flat black lace-up shoes, to the fresh sunflowers on the table, seemed a comfortable fit. For 21 years, Lady Bird has lived on her own, without her famous husband. Her stature was once derived from Lyndon Johnson's position. But make no mistake, today it comes from the force of her personality. Throughout their highly public marriage, Lady Bird benefited from the comparison with LBJ. He was ham-handed, gruff, often offensive. She was gentle, polite, always easy company. He was prone to excess and violent mood swings, and a careless pursuer of women. She was balanced, calm, and committed to the awesome responsibility of keeping him under control. In the hard times, he gave us controversy over Vietnam. She gave us the Eden-like serenity of gardens. Over the years, she became the embodiment of much of what we think about Texas women of her generation. To begin with, there's her hair, rolled, teased, waved at the front, and sprayed into place. Go to any garden club in Texas on any day of the year, and you'll find a room full of Lady Bird wannabes. Nellie Connolly, John's wife, copied her hairstyle. So did Janie Briscoe, Dolph's wife. Ann Richards adapted it slightly, turning it into a silver helmet suitable for war. Then there's Lady Bird's manner. Nice, but unwavering, and always a little suspicious that a conversation is about to turn into criticism of Lyndon. Whenever I look at a photograph of her, I see a template of my mother and my grandmother. Women who sacrificed their own wants and desires for their families, and therefore would not allow anyone to say an unkind word. By now, of course, many biographers have spoken ill of Lyndon Johnson, calling him everything from an adulterer to a thief. It's not surprising, then, that Lady Bird has been reluctant to speak publicly. It has been several years since she gave an in-depth interview to the media, and this particular interview was first requested more than 3 years ago. She moved into her high-ceilinged living room, its walls filled with pictures of flowers and scenes from nature, and looked out her window for deer among the scrubby woods below. "I'm in constant battle with the deer out here," she said. "I feel sorry for the poor deer. The land is so built up now, there's nothing for them to eat. They're starving, but they still make me mad." This is the way Mrs. Johnson naturally talks, of the outdoors, the deer, the weather, the way heavenly light ought to fall down on the land near sundown, and a good deal about getting the colors just right for a meadow of wildflowers she's thinking about planting. She will be 82 years old on December 22nd, and this year's birthday signals the onset of yet another phase of her relationship with the earth. This spring, she will open the new location of the National Wildflower Research Center on a 42-acre site southwest of Austin. Our interview took place over an 8-hour period at her house in Austin, during lunch at an Austin restaurant, and on the grounds of the new Wildflower Center. Once she started talking, she seemed happy, even eager, to reminisce about her life. "Let's talk a while to history," I said to Lady Bird, as I placed a tape recorder between us before the interview began. "Oh, yes," she said, staring into her coffee cup reflectively. "Let's do." "What are the biggest changes you've seen in Texas?" When we began public service in 1937, Texas was a rural agricultural state. The biggest voting bloc was the farmers and ranchers. Things really changed when Lyndon helped FDR get the Rural Electrification Act through the House in 1936. Until then, farmers and their wives had no electricity. Once they got dams, they got electricity, and then farm-to-market roads. Then both men and women had a way to get to the city to work. It really opened up the state. 58 years later, Texas is an urban, technological state. Some days, I hardly recognize it. I'm not really sure that Lyndon could be elected today in Texas. For one thing, he was never really comfortable with television. Lyndon liked owning TV stations, but as far as using it as a tool of explanation, persuasion, a transfer of himself and his beliefs and desires into the public mind, he didn't ever really make friends with television. He was a son of the courthouse steps. He loved going to the county seat on a Saturday afternoon and mingling with the old farmers with their drooping mustaches. They would chew tobacco and sit, looking very intently at you, as if they were peering into your mind to get to whatever you were talking about. What has happened since President Johnson died that would have made him angry or troubled? In many ways, I guess you could say Lyndon was lucky he died when he did. He couldn't have borne to see the presidency denigrated in the minds of the people the way it has been since Watergate. I don't mean to add to the many bad things that have been said about President Nixon. I just mean the public reaction to the office since Watergate has continued to decline. That would have troubled Lyndon. Then, of course, Lyndon died before John Connally became a Republican. That would have been hard for him to take, but he died in an era when party discipline meant something. To Lyndon, party discipline was everything. I don't think he would have ever become a Republican himself, but he would have been sorely pushed if Nelson Rockefeller had been nominated because he liked him so much as a person and as a public servant. Also, I just don't think he would have believed that we had come to the point in our country when people were talking openly about the failure of the public school system. He couldn't have swallowed that, because the public school system is one of the landmarks of America. We are perhaps the only country that has succeeded in offering an education to every child. Lyndon passed more than 60 bills about education as president. everything from Head Start to adult education, and he would never have given up the ideal of public schools. LBJ was the first president in modern history to find himself hated as a person as well as for his policies. But since then, every president, including President Clinton, has evoked the same kind of visceral hatred that Johnson did over Vietnam. What do you think triggered his unpopularity? I think the reason that so many people got angry at Lyndon was because he stuffed so many changes down the nation's throat. Don't imagine that the Vietnam War was the hardest thing for him to take. Oh no, it was not. The upheaval over civil rights was harder on him. I think because it was our own people, the people we grew up with, who were waving the placards and glaring. I remember some of Lyndon's best advisors came to him when he was about to launch full-scale civil rights through the Congress. They told him, "You better not do this. You're very popular right now, and you're going to lose it all over civil rights." And I remember Lyndon told them, "What's political capital for, then, if you don't use it?" What would he think of the changes his legislative agenda has brought about? Lyndon took great satisfaction in getting the Voting Rights Act through Congress. However, he seemed to know intuitively that the bill would make us more of a two-party nation. I remember that he walked into the family quarters of the White House, and there were a few people there ready to do a post-mortem on the bill. There were always a few close friends who gathered around at the end of a long fight just to talk things over. "Well," Lyndon told them, "I think I just may have handed the solid Democratic South to the Republican Party." As Lady Bird talked, we were seated on the back porch of her two-level home. She wore white-rimmed glasses to shade her eyes from the sun. In the distance stood the Capitol and the University of Texas Tower. It was pleasant just to listen to the sound of her voice. Its rhythm is velvety, lilting, definitely Southern, but with hardly a twang at all. By the sound of it, she could be from Charleston or Atlanta. "That was a wonderful day," she said, recalling one of many days past. "I've had so many wonderful days." I showed her a copy of a letter she wrote to Lyndon when he worked as an administrative aide to Congressman Dick Cleburne. It was written 1 month after their first date over breakfast at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, and 1 month before they were married in San Antonio. Lyndon had asked her to marry him on that first date, and by the time she wrote the letter, the wine of youth, as Lady Bird described it to me, was clearly flowing. "Dearest beloved, your letter Saturday morning just came. I think it's funny nobody has noticed that I look different. I feel different. Lyndon, please tell me as soon as you can what the deal is. I'm afraid it's politics. Oh, I know I haven't any business, not any proprietary interest, but I would hate for you to go into politics. Don't let me get things any more muddled for you than they are, though, dearest." Her ellipses. Bird. "Did you change your mind about politics?" "Oh, yes, I did. I remember the first public utterance of mine was about politics. I guess it was in the first congressional race in 1937, when Lyndon and I were just starting out in public service. I was sitting at a banquet when somebody leaned over and said, 'You might be called on to say just a word or two.' So I wrote something down on the back of an envelope. It was very simple, about two sentences long, about how politics could be a wonderful life for a man and his wife. And so it did turn out for me, but I cannot say that's true these days." Many biographers have had unpleasant things to say about your husband's private life. Some have suggested that he may have been a manic depressive. Do you think that's true? I think the world is too strung up about psychology today and too intrusive into the private thoughts of public figures. When people ask me these sort of things, I just say, look to your own lives. Look to yourself. Everybody. Fix yourselves and keep your problems to yourself. The public should weigh what their public servants are doing, not their private innermost feelings. We need to ask, are these policies working for America, or are they doing harm? I think we are getting into a state of wanting to know so much about the intimacy of everyone's lives that we don't judge people by what they do for this country. Lyndon was certainly a man of high emotions and strong feelings, of strong joys and strong pains. Life with him was an adventure, always exciting. He was awfully happy about his victories and awfully crushed about his defeats. But I never saw him too crushed to keep working. How did you feel about his accepting the vice presidential nomination after he lost a chance at the presidency? I cannot say that I really wanted Lyndon to accept the vice presidency in 1960. It all happened so fast, and I was uncertain that it was the wisest course. But his role as majority leader of the Senate had played out. He had done all he could do. I guess you could say that the orange had been sucked dry. Lyndon knew that it would not be the same job in a new administration. He had served with a Republican president and a sizable Democratic majority and a very powerful Democratic speaker in the House. Those were political characteristics that allowed Lyndon to work and get a lot of things done. It would be a very different atmosphere to have a Democratic president and a Democratic majority. The White House would be setting legislative policies, not the majority leader. On the other hand, he realized the vice presidency had no real power and wouldn't be as important a job either. But the way I viewed it, at least as vice president, he'd still preside over the Senate, and it could be the capstone of his career there. Do you think Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy? I have no doubt that the findings of the Warren Commission are correct. I guess the two oddest committees Lyndon ever had to put together were the one to decide what to do about Senator Joseph McCarthy and the one he appointed to look into the assassination. Lyndon was very concerned about the possibility of a conspiracy when it first happened. The reason he wanted to get on that plane in Dallas and get airborne as soon as possible and get sworn in as president had to do with his fears about a conspiracy. But he certainly wasn't going to get that plane in the air until the president's body and Mrs. Kennedy were aboard. He appointed the best people he could find to look into the matter, and they researched it until they sucked all the information dry. After the report came out, we all just wanted to get on with the business of the nation. When did things start to return to normal after the assassination? We didn't move into the White House until December 7th. The main thing I remember was how black it all was. The White House was full of beautiful chandeliers, but they were all swabbed in black net. Everywhere I looked, the house was draped in black. It has been long the custom in our country to mourn the president for a month. And so on December 22nd, which happened to be my birthday, Lyndon saw to it that the black net came off. We put up Christmas decorations, and I walked the well-lit halls for the first time with the sense that life was going to go on, that we as a country were going to begin again. What was your relationship like with Jackie Kennedy? There was a distance of age between Mrs. Kennedy and me, and frankly, she belonged in a different society frame than I do. However, I liked her, and I think she liked me. In private, she had humor and a laughing side. But I felt, and I think a great many people felt, that she came across as a little girl you wanted to help. On the other hand, I always recognized there was steel beneath that exceedingly youthful exterior. After the assassination, Lyndon and I treated her exactly as she asked to be treated. She sent word to us that the house held too many sad memories for her to ever visit there. She wanted her privacy, and we gave it to her, although I was real proud of Lyndon for writing to her and her children. She knew he would have done anything he could to ease her grief. On the last summer of her life, I had lunch with her on Martha's Vineyard. Her home had the unmistakable imprint, and oh, how she loved it. I guess one of the sad, sad things about her death was that she had finally attained what she had wanted and that she was not to be a public figure. Which former first ladies are you closest to? And how do you think the role of first lady has changed over the years? Perhaps the fondest relationship I've had is with Betty Ford. She and I knew each other when our husbands were leaders in Congress. Both of us were members of the 81st Club, an organization for congressional wives, and we shared a lot of memories. But all the first ladies have been nice to me. I've also had a warm, admiring relationship with Barbara Bush. I am closer to her than I am to Hillary Clinton because Barbara and I both come from Texas. We're closer to the same age, and we've shared so much of history. My relationship with the Clintons is totally from a distance. I think that Hillary Clinton is proving that the role of First Lady has marched with the times. I saw my role as giving Lyndon a little island of peace, a comfortable setting in which to work. It's a big, important role, and I don't think that role should be denigrated. On the other hand, Mrs. Clinton is a product of the cultural and social change of the last good many decades. I listen to her public speeches, and I think she is a strong, intelligent woman who handles herself well. I tip my hat to both of the Clintons. As I used to say when things were at their worst in Lyndon's presidency, the greatest courage is just to get out of bed in the morning and get back to work. You defined yourself as a helpmate and extension of Johnson. Is that right? Yes, absolutely. And I don't think I was limited by that. I was able to continue to learn new things. Personally, I regret that women these days don't stay home with their children until the children are at least in school. I realize I have no right to express myself on this point because I'm not raising children in this day and age, and I'm not undergoing the same economic pressures that young people today have to face. However, I think young mothers today are missing one of life's greatest opportunities, to help babies grow up and train them well. I had a lot of help rearing my two daughters, and goodness knows, I'm glad for every bit that I had. But these days, people live so much longer than they used to, and women can have a career after their children are in school, or even after they are in high school. Do you have any advice for the first woman president? Someday I think we will have a woman president, but since I'm almost 82, it's not going to be in my time. She will have to overcome a natural, inborn, cultural prejudice that the man is the leader of the family and therefore should be the leader of the nation. I hope for her sake that she is healthy, both spiritually and physically, and that she has a husband who is very understanding and supportive. I also hope she has a lot of smart daughters to help her out. A president needs somebody to carry the emotional load that wives and families have traditionally carried. Many times in our conversation, Lady Bird talked about how time has passed her by. She sounded cheerful, but also resigned. Once, I asked her about Johnson's great society programs and whether a new kind of approach to social welfare was in order for the upcoming millennium, an approach based on something other than a handout. "Oh my," she said, "I'm going to leave such problems to another generation." Lady Bird is from a different time and place. I wanted to know what she remembered about her own upbringing. She was born Claudia Alta Taylor in Karnak on December 22, 1912, and nicknamed at age 2 by a black nurse who pronounced the child purdy as a ladybird. Both of her parents, Thomas Jefferson Taylor and Minnie Lee Patillo, came from Alabama. Her father, called Cap'n or Boss by his mostly black workers, was the richest man in Harrison County. Her mother died when Lady Bird was only 5, and in her solitude, she made a connection with nature. In most of the early photographs of Lady Bird, she is standing among trees or near rivers. Her love of nature gave her a life of her own, which is probably how she survived the turbulence of the 60s and private hard times as well. What was your life like after your mother died? When I was 6, my Aunt Effie came from Alabama to help Daddy raise us. She was my mother's sister. As we said in those days, she was a maiden sister, a spinster. She was the sweetest person generally, but she had no idea of discipline, no idea of how to choose the right clothes, or how to put a girl in the right society. She did, however, love beauty and nature, and she spent hours explaining how lovely the fields and meadows could be. She taught me how to listen to the wind in the pine trees and to the way birds sing. My life consisted of roaming the hills, creeks, and woods, and playing with 2 little black girls who were my own age. Occasionally, in an effort to do what she presumed she ought to do, Aunt Effie would import the daughters of some friends for me to play with. The girls and I would sit around looking at each other. I can't say it was a great success. I was a child of nature. I went wherever I wanted to go, and if I got lost, I'd come across some black person, most likely, and they would recognize me. "Which way is it back to the brick house?" I'd ask, and they'd show me the way home. I've heard it said that you took as much pride in the passage of the Civil Rights Act as Lyndon did, because you grew up in such a segregated society. How were your attitudes about race formed? I came from a part of Texas, deep East Texas, that was heavily populated by blacks, and it was the hardest place in Texas for civil rights changes to be made. The part of the world I grew up in was just like the old South, transplanted. It was cotton culture, plain, simple, hard country, just like Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. I remember once, when I was a little girl, that a group of white men cornered a black man in the middle of the night and accused him of some crime. The poor man was so terrified that he just took off running. When he did, the white men shot him in the back. It happened near Karnak. I heard about it the next morning, and I was just a little girl, but I remember thinking to myself, "This isn't right. Somebody ought to change this." Lyndon did. In The Path to Power, Robert Caro describes you as a wallflower. Were you a wallflower? I never thought of myself that way, but I did wear saddle shoes when the other girls were wearing silk stockings and lipstick. I was always scared to death when some boy sat down by me and began to talk. But this was the period when I was 11 to 13 and going to school in Karnak, and 13 to 15 when I went to high school in Marshall. I did not have any beaux then, but when I got to Austin in the spring, after my 17th birthday, I just blossomed. From the time I was 17, until I left the university, I had all the bows I could handle. I had a lot of fun. Crazy, wild city fun. I think I fell in love every April. Like most people, Lady Bird has built her life in retirement around memories. If her house caught on fire, she told me, there are only two items that she would grab before running outside. Buck and water Linda, after the birth of her daughter Lucinda. And one of LBJ and their daughter Lucy, after the birth of Lucy's daughter, Lynn. Lady Bird's bedroom is painted in soothing shades of pink and green. I love all kinds of pink, she told me as she walked through the room. A TV tray with breakfast dishes still on it stood near her bed. In the middle of the floor was a white towel on which she had done her morning exercises. Walking into a solarium dominated by an enormous hot tub, she exclaimed, here is my bow to total self-indulgence. Were you prepared for LBJ's death? Lyndon always told me, you know, I'm not going to live to be an old man. That would make me mad, but I knew it was true. Lyndon had his first massive heart attack in July 1955. He had a second massive one in April 1972 when we were visiting Linda and Chuck, Linda's husband, on our way up to see Mrs. Eisenhower. At the time, Dr. Willis Hurst, one of our marvelous friends and Lyndon's doctor, took me aside and told me, I want you to know that with as many blocked up arteries as he has, he will die suddenly. And it won't matter if the five best cardiologists in the United States are in the room. It just won't matter. For the next 6 months, there were repeated angina attacks. Lyndon described them as hurting almost as much as kidney stones. So we lived the last bit to the fullest. On our last Christmas of his life, he sat at his desk at the ranch and signed book after book of his memoirs. I said, Lyndon, that's more books than you can possibly give away this Christmas. And he looked up at me and sort of smiled slowly and sadly and said, the library can use them sometime. We had a happy Christmas together. He got to know four of his seven grandchildren. I have some funny pictures of him riding with some of the grandchildren on the lawn mower around the airplane terminal at the ranch. All the grandkids called him Papa. I remember Lyndon dressed up as Santa Claus, and one of the grandchildren climbed up on his lap and looked at him and said, this isn't Santa Claus, it's Papa. What did you do when you were on your own, without LBJ? The biggest thing that ever happened to me on my own was being a regent at UT for 6 years. I remember when Governor Preston Smith called in late 1970 and asked me to be on the board. I felt greatly honored, but I told him I couldn't accept. Lyndon was pretty sick at the time, and I told Governor Smith that I did not want to be away from him a lot. Lyndon was lying in bed resting. When I hung up the telephone, he said, come in here. I think I know what you were talking about, but tell me. So I told him. He said, how did you feel when I would try to convince some really capable citizen to take a government job, a cabinet post, or head an agency, anything in the service of his country? And he said no, because his family didn't want to move to Washington or because he was climbing up the ladder in his company. I had strong feelings about that. Lyndon knew that. I always wanted him to get the best people. So Lyndon told me to get back on the telephone and tell Preston Smith I'd be glad to do it if he hadn't already appointed someone else. So after my usual protestations, I did. You had a fundraiser for Chuck Robb at the ranch and went to Virginia to campaign for him in his Senate race. What do you think of his opponent, Oliver North? Chuck's race in Virginia was about as bad a campaign as I've ever seen. We're in an ugly, contentious mood in America. I hope it will pass. These days, I just turn my TV dial looking for something that's not about O.J. Simpson. Maybe I look at politics through the veil of time, but when Lyndon and I were in it, there was a basic feeling of camaraderie. You traded philosophies. You talked about your part of the country. You talked about what you had to have. But you didn't hate people who had different philosophies, and you didn't oppose just to oppose. I don't think Linda will wind up being marred by all this, in the sense of becoming bitter or angry. Linda is one of the smartest people I know, and she has strong spiritual roots that she doesn't wear on her sleeve. In politics, you see the best of people, and sometimes you see the worst. Sometimes people that were your dearest friends may not be able to support you because of business considerations. It's easy to be bitter or angry, but I don't believe Linda will fall victim. I've never met Oliver North, and I'm not in the judgment business. But let me just say that I want to be represented by someone solid, stable, someone I believe to be looking out for the best interests of the country. I think what he had to say during the campaign about President Clinton not being his commander-in-chief was a wild and loose thing to say. Clinton is his commander-in-chief. He may not be his choice, but he is his commander-in-chief for another 2 years and 2 months. He may not like it, but that's the way it is. As we drove from her house to the Wildflower Research Center, Lady Bird pointed out the hike and bike trail along Town Lake in Austin, one of the projects she helped raise money for when she returned to Texas in 1969. What you want out of these kinds of places is use, joyous use, she said. We have to get more and more places where people can get exercise and fresh air. These days, Lady Bird spends her days relaxing at the LBJ Ranch in Stonewall, attending events at the Presidential Library in Austin, and supervising construction and fundraising for the Wildflower Center. Why have you devoted so much time to wildflowers? I don't like homogenized country. When Lyndon and I came back to Texas in 1969, I was dismayed that every place was starting to look like every place else. The meadows and the hillsides were all being replaced by highway grids and shopping malls. I wanted to try to restore some of our native habitat. We in Texas are blessed with what we have. I just want Texas to keep on looking like Texas. It's a modest ambition, but it's mine. What do you think your legacy will be? I'm not interested in any legacy. The Wildflower Center is my love. I can't control the purity of the air or solve the problem of acid rain, but the Wildflower Center is an effort to fill a little niche in the whole environmental picture. If we can get people to see the beauty of the native flora of their own corner of the world with caring eyes, then I'll be real happy. Do you believe in heaven? Oh, yes, I do, but I don't presume to know what heaven will be like. But I do know that there is something hereafter, because all this has been too significant, too magnificent, for there not to be something after. I have some friends who believe that the pearly gates are really gates and not really pearly. Not for me. I prefer to leave it as a great mystery. I like adventure. I've gone through my life liking adventure, and that's the way I like to think of heaven. It will be a once-in-a-lifetime, never-to-be-repeated, wonderful adventure. Near the end of our day together, we were walking on the grounds of the Wildflower Research Center. Lady Bird tapped her way across a field, using her cane to find two particular yaupon bushes she had planted earlier. She knew exactly where the bushes should be, but she couldn't see them. "My eyesight is deteriorating badly," she said. I'm legally blind in one eye and see very little in the other. I've got a condition called macular degeneration, something that 10 million of us in the country have. Even nature dwindles now. The timbre of her voice was matter-of-fact, resolute. Do you see any bushes in there that have any red berries on them? Lady Bird asked me. I scanned the area, looking for the missing yaupons. If they look gray to you, I'm going to slide in and butt my head against one of these rocks, she said. If they're gray, they're defoliated, and that's a bad sign. At that moment, I spotted the yaupons. I see the red berries, I told her. She looked as relieved and contented as a farmer who had just been told her crops had been spared and she wouldn't have to sell the family farm. Oh, good, she said, staring at a patch of ground in the direction of the bushes. Tell me what they look like.
Hello, this is Kay. I'm going to read an article from the Texas Monthly Archives. Texas Primer, Frito Pie. Corn chips smothered with chili. How can you top that? With onions and cheese, of course. By Michael Hilton. Issue, November 1986. Have you ever seen Texas from an airplane on a Friday night in the fall? Have you ever seen Texas from an airplane on a Friday night in the fall? Down in the flat darkness are 1,000 bright oases of brilliant lights with green rectangular fields in the middle. If you could fly low enough, you might see boys running up and down the field, slamming into one another, and girls cheering them on. You might see fans sitting on hard bleachers, raising their fists in the air and shouting. And you might see any of these people, or all of them, for that matter, eating Frito pies. That's right, Frito pies are still a mainstay at football games. Sometimes they aren't served in the bag anymore. After all, it's hard to open one of those miracle plastic bags of Fritos with your hands these days. But even in a styrofoam container, it's the same old Frito pie. Fritos smothered with chili is a greasy, spicy delight. How can you beat that? Add some shredded cheese. Add some strong onion. Frito pie is a marriage made in heaven. You know why? Because corn and chili powder go together. They've probably gone together since the Maya, and they go together today. That's the secret of Tex-Mex cuisine. Corn and chili are complementary flavors. But that's not the whole story. Fritos are salty and absorbent. If you want to get technical, Fritos absorb grease, and good chili has a lot of grease. Furthermore, the Frito retains its crispness even when chock full of grease. Try chili on top of potato chips if you don't believe me. In fact, try chili with Doritos or Tostitos or any one of the other dry corn chips. It won't do. The Frito has integrity. And look, Frito, a Spanish word, means fried. I'm sure they fry Fritos in the purest of vegetable oils nowadays. Lord help us. But the idea remains the same. When I first began to contemplate the Frito pie, I called a friend in Chicago. She had never heard of it. I tried San Francisco. My friend out there had no clue as to what I was talking about. I tried a close friend in New York who eats out constantly and also studies food. He said there was no such thing in his experience. He wanted to know how it was done. I told him that you slit a bag of Fritos lengthwise and just ladle in the chili. He said he would try it, but I don't have much hope, even though it is possible to find Frito pie in some New York restaurants. Television news host Linda Ellerbe remembers the Frito pies of her native state with such nostalgia that she coaxed a New York eatery into including the dish on its menu. And a New York restaurateur, Calvin Holt, is so proud of his gourmet chili pie casserole, complete with sour cream, Monterey Jack, and cream cheeses, that he spurred the Uptown versus Down-Home Chili Pie Challenge, whose results should be known by Thanksgiving. Still, Texas remains the best place to savor Frito pie in a big way. In October, the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang cooked up a 20-foot-long, 10,000-pound Frito pie as part of the Permian Basin Oil Show. The origin of the Frito pie is heavily disputed. One day I saw a delivery truck driver in the Oak Lawn section of Dallas walk into a 7-Eleven at lunchtime and buy a big bag of Fritos and a can of chili. He microwaved the chili, paid his tab, walked outside, slit the bag with a pocket knife, poured the chili over the Fritos, and ate his meal while contemplating the traffic. Did that man invent the Frito pie? Maybe. But Frito-Lay of Dallas likes to think that Daisy Doolin, the mother of the company's founder, was the first to pour chili over Fritos in the 30s. The Doolins had so many Fritos around the house, you know, like so much turkey after Thanksgiving, and they were living in San Antonio, where chili is common, and all in all, that's probably how the pie came to be. But others have claimed credit for it, and that makes sense, because you cannot avoid pouring chili over Fritos. Tonight, you'll find Frito pie on the dinner table in 1,000 homes, from the Red River to the Rio Grande, and 100 school cafeterias will schedule it for lunch tomorrow. But don't take my word for any of this. Sometime this fall, when the weather is crisp, go out to a rural football game, the farther west the better, and pay a dollar for a Frito pie. The lady in the concession stand will tell you that she made the chili herself, and the hot bag of Fritos will warm your hands. The team will score, and you'll gobble down the pie with a plastic spoon and never forget it.
Here's an article from Texas Monthly's April 1987 edition. The Flash Flood. The forecast predicts sunny skies, clear nights, and in Texas, that doesn't mean a thing. Few weather events equal the flash flood in excitement. The very phrase sounds dangerous, conjuring visions of torrential rain that quickly transforms front yards into lakes and quiet streets into raging rivers, and threatens to sweep the whole neighborhood into the Gulf of Mexico. One minute the sun is shining, the birds are singing, and the brook is babbling. The next, the sky darkens, the rain begins, and it's time to batten down the hatch. Little white lines of type float across the bottom of the TV screen, and an intrusive beeping sound announces the potential for flash flooding. A watch is declared if flooding is imminent or already occurring in the vicinity. Either way, it's time for constant vigilance, for no event wreaks havoc quite so quickly or thoroughly as the flash flood. Although Texas is a land of contrasts, you usually have to drive 1,000 miles to discover that fact. A flash flood can save you the mileage. Within hours, drought can turn to flood. The rains that fell over the hill country on August 2, 1978, for example, broke a severe 6-week dry spell by dumping more than 20 inches of precipitation in the headwaters of the Guadalupe, Medina, and Sabino rivers in a few hours, causing record flow rates and numerous deaths. If Texas seems to get more than its share of flash floods, that's because its location, between the Rocky Mountains and the Gulf, attracts both rain-laden cold fronts from Canada and warm, moist air from the south. As such systems stall and dissipate over Texas, they drop intense rains over small areas. In 1921, a rainstorm moved north from Mexico before becoming stationary over central Texas. On September 9th, the system set a U.S. record by unleashing 36 inches of rain in 18 hours on the farming community of Thrall. The flash floods spawned in the area killed 215 people. The sparsely vegetated limestone terrain of the Hill Country and Edwards Plateau is especially prone to flash floods, as is evidenced by the numerous low water crossing signs and flood gauges posted along normally idyllic shallow rivers, streams, and dry washes. Add a thin layer of saturated topsoil and miles of pavement, and you have the ingredients for a full-blown gully washer or frog drowner. Every Texan worth his barometer understands that the flash flood's inherent danger is its potential to strike almost any rivulet anytime. You expect the Mississippi to spill its banks on a semi-regular basis. A creek that you normally ford in one giant step doesn't command that kind of respect until it rains and rains some more. How many times have otherwise sensible people hopped in their cars to see which bridges have washed out instead of staying home as the weatherman advised? Low water crossings mark the graves of many foolhardy souls unaccustomed to the vagaries of Texas weather. "I can make it," are the famous last words of Tin Horns before they gun their engine and try to plow through a raging torrent. "A lot of newcomers are lost in Volkswagens that way," says meteorologist James C. Fiddler. Then there are those who understand the risks, but nonetheless regard flash floods as sport. When desert rats in the Big Bend spot a heavy thunderstorm in the distance, they consult a set of topographical maps, calculate the direction of the runoff, and head for a dry wash. If their predictions are correct, they are rewarded with an ominous rumble that heralds a flash flood's arrival. They compare the spectacle of water barreling through the wash and crumbling banks along its way to the calving of glaciers. My respect for flash floods was instilled on Memorial Day weekend, 1981, when 7 inches of rain fell on already saturated ground in Austin. Shoal Creek jumped its banks and threatened to flood my downtown office. Before I could reach the place, my car was met by a rush of water and began to float away. I jumped out, took refuge on the second floor of the building, and watched as the water carried several cars, the garage, and the back stairway toward Town Lake. As quickly as 4 feet of water had entered the building, it retreated, leaving a thick layer of mud as a calling card. By the time a rescue boat puttered to the front porch, I could slosh through the muck unassisted. 13 lives were claimed by the waters that night. I got out easy, losing only my record collection and a few sundry possessions. But I experienced a brush with death that I will never forget. Now here's a Texas Monthly article from August 1988. Texas Primer, The Dust Storm. When all of Texas seems about to blow away, the best defense is a sense of humor. By Ann Dingus. True Grit. Pioneers who didn't have it before their first sandstorm certainly did after. That's why cowboys said a spunky fellow had sand. Though rarely lethal, sandstorms are universally despised. Nothing can keep out flying sand. Not closed windows, not bandanas, not prayer. Wet rags under the door help, but not much. Sandstorms spell trouble. An 1895 storm blew down section houses along the Texas and Pacific Railway tracks. A 60s spate of Oklahoma rain, chased by a blizzard, dumped brown snow across the high plains. A pair of 1977 dust storms ruined $6 million worth of winter wheat in the panhandle and injured people in El Paso. With Texas, one of the 30 states now stricken by drought, new tales may be on the way. Any Texan can tell you a sandstorm story. Native writers appreciated its drama. Tom Lee set the opening chapter of The Wonderful Country in one. And in Lonesome Dove, green cowhand Newt suffered baptism by sand on his second day up the trail. The gutless heroine of Dorothy Scarborough's 1925 novel, The Wind, hated the sand. Her eyes smarted with it. Her throat choked with it. When she lay down at night, her pillow was scratchy with its covering of sand. She could feel the grains crawling inside of her clothing like vermin. Wind is, of course, the moving force behind a sandstorm. When the north winds howl into Texas, they displace rising hot air and snatch up any loose soil in their path. The stronger and faster the winds, the more sand they push up before them. An equally strong factor is drought. The drier the land, the looser the topsoil, and the more easily the upper layer is swept away. Although most Texans use the term dust storm and sandstorm interchangeably, the legendary sandstorms of the past are as rare today as they are ferocious. Decades ago, prairie grass protected most of the soil on the plains, but pockets of sand blew about freely. Eventually, however, years of sustained plowing exposed millions of acres of dirt and made dust storms more common. Because dirt is finer grained than sand, a storm flings it higher and faster. Thus, sandstorms hang low on the horizon. Dust storms boil up like thunderheads. A final difference is color. Sandstorms are yellow. Dust storms are brown. In 1934, a 6-year dry spell and poor land management produced the Dust Bowl, withering farms across the Panhandle and the Great Plains. By 1936, the Amarillo Weather Bureau had counted 192 dusters locally. No wonder the Amarillo High School team is called the Sandstorm, the Sandies for short. Dust storms and poverty drove people out of their homes to seek new beginnings elsewhere. One of them was songwriter Woody Guthrie, who abandoned his job as a sign painter in Pampa to hitch a ride west to California and fortune. He told the first truck driver who stopped that he wanted out of this damn dust. Dust storms can occur statewide at any time of the year, but they are most prevalent in the high plains, particularly in a 20-county area around Lubbock, and most often in late winter or early spring. During the typical Dust Bowl storm, 122 tons of dirt an hour blew through Lubbock. But the worst duster of the century pummeled the area on January 25, 1965. Streetlights came on at noon and soon disappeared in the roiling dust. Tumbleweeds raced past motorists on the highway, back when the speed limit was 70. Airline pilots reported dust at 31,000 feet, 6 miles high. The storm scoured the paint off pickups and dumped 3.5 inches of grit into the rain gauge at Reese Air Force Base. The Lubbock Avalanche Journal reported wryly that farmers couldn't do much except stay inside and watch their farms travel. Humor is the only weapon against flying dust and sand, and in that department, Midland takes honors. In 1955, the Reporter-Telegram announced the formation of the Sandstorm Advisory Board, whose one and only duty was to name the storms, in a far-sighted move after men. The first name chosen was, naturally, Adam. The second, Benson, after then-Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson. And folklorist J. Frank Dobie saw the sunny side of the issue. He told of a Texas Ranger who, in the aftermath of a sandstorm, spied a cowboy hat on the ground. Picking it up, the Ranger discovered a man's head underneath. Frantically, he dug out the buried cowpoke, who coughed, spat, and croaked out, "Get a shovel. there's a good horse under me. Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly Archives. As volunteers and staff from the Recording Library of West Texas, next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 76 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or perhaps a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome one and all to the Make-Believe Ballroom. I hope you're all doing well today. A melancholy type of show I have planned for you. As I have mentioned on the ballroom before, August the 21st, 1935, was a historic day for swing. Benny Goodman and his orchestra were in California. They were in Los Angeles, headed for the renowned Palomar Ballroom. In Benny's mind on August 21st, he felt that this might very well be his last performance as a band leader. He was very discouraged at the reception his band was receiving, and he thought it might be better to disband and get rid of all the aggravation and return to work as a freelance clarinetist. So at the Palomar, Benny and the orchestra took to the stage and they started playing. And the crowd was initially uninspired. And I think this exasperated Benny. So I guess Goodman, with nothing to lose, threw caution to the wind. And he pulled out some new arrangements and just let the band cut loose. And cut loose, Goodman and the guys did. In addition to the dancers cutting loose on the floor at the Palomar, Benny, for the first time ever, was playing swing, and it was a new form of jazz, and the crowd went crazy. They went crazy to the King Porter Stomp that night with a Fletcher Henderson arrangement and the added bonus of Bunny Berrigan playing the trumpet. Thank you. So swing, a derivative of 1920s jazz, and that historic Goodman Night swept the nation and became wildly popular for its emphasis on offbeat tempos, which lent well to dancing. And dance they did, as the era opened a whole slew of new ballrooms and clubs where tens of thousands took to the dance floor to swing. Benny Goodman was in the Palomar in 1935, and by 1936, swing had become the most popular music in the United States. And as swing matured, so did the ballrooms. Many of these venues would combine music and dancing with dinner, that giving an all-inclusive experience for the guests. So that's all well and good, and we're talking about the start of the history, the upbeat, heady start of the history to swing. But now the melancholy aspect to today's edition of the Make Believe Ballroom. Swing started in 35. However, by the end of World War II, swing clubs had begun to die out, and with it, swing and big bands as a whole. So our beloved swing and big band music that we play here on the Make Believe Ballroom each week had in essence a lifespan of only 10 years. And when you really think about it, that's kind of shocking for how popular it was. On today's program, I'm going to play some of my swing era favorites, combined with that melancholy aspect of why swing and big bands died out. Think about that, and some of the reasons you think swing might have met its ultimate fate. So on the ballroom, a lot of swing music with some of the sad reasons it disappeared. Coupled with the fact that through old recordings and modern swing and big bands playing today, it's still enjoyed by millions, as you can attest to as listeners to the Make Believe Ballroom. Let's go with